Life is a challenge, and we are in for one for quite some period of time. Hopefully you and yours are faring well during this bout with COVID-19. It's just incredible what is literally happening. And I want to share some thoughts from some very good guests who are going to join us on our program this morning. In the first hour of our program, I'm pleased to say that we are joined by a gentleman who has spoken with us before on our program. Last time he was on, we had a very lively discussion that we worked some of you into as well. Jonathan Bell is joining us in the first hour of our program. He is a labor and employment attorney and founder of Bell Law Group. And he is joining us to talk with us about this COVID-19 situation and employees. Jonathan, first of all, good morning. Welcome to our program on The Fan again.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks again for having me on.
It's nice to have you join us. How have you and your family been faring?
It's been a busy time just because of the nature of what I do. I'm getting a lot of calls and inquiries from employers and employees alike. My law firm is trying to do our part in the community. We're giving out all free advice relating to COVID-19 situations, whether it be layoffs or the new laws that have been passed by New York State and federal laws. So we've been busy. We've been serving our community. And, of course, given the situation and the dire need for good legal advice and sound legal advice, we haven't been charging anything for our services.
Well, I guess one of the questions that naturally comes up is this whole idea of, because a lot of people are at this point saying, all right, how do we really get through this? As employees, what do you say? What advice do you give?
Well, it's funny how things have changed from earlier in the week until now. You know, the first number of callers had to deal with, you know, people who either felt sick and didn't want to go in, but the employer was forcing them, or the employer has someone coming in they felt was sick. They wanted to know their rights to send the individual home. And now it's evolved to, well, basically everybody's home except for the what's deemed essential. And I'm getting asked by employers, how could they just fire everybody? Is there any better alternative because they feel loyal to the employees that work so hard for them? So we started to talk, which I could describe to your audience in the program, about furlough, which is a nice option. And people have been calling us relating now to filing unemployment claims. And I've been on top of the news as far as federally what they're going to do. I think Schumer yesterday was on CNN and said something about some federal relief would be incredible and really relieve a lot of stress. What he's trying to get past is 4 months of federal unemployment where you get paid 100% of your salary, which is not what unemployment normally does. 100%, it includes independent contractors, which unemployment never does. So it really expands unemployment, the amounts they pay, and what people are losing out on for 4 months, which really, if the federal government could pull that off, and apparently is getting some bipartisan support, if they could pull that off, that would be a huge, huge relief. They're talking about this costing about $200 trillion. So it's going to be a lot of money. But at the same token, you know, I'm getting a lot of calls, and everybody knows, you know, people are suffering. Not only, you know, let's talk about the people who are sick. We're putting that aside. There's a lot of just people who aren't sick, and they're concerned about their mortgage payments and their credit and putting food on the table and shelter. So there's a lot going on in our country right now, Bob. I'm sure you know.
I do, and, you know, it's only going to heighten. First of all, as we move closer to the end of the month, the start of the new month, and then as weeks turn into months with this, you know, one of the things that has come up, and I did see the news reports last night about this proposal on Capitol Hill. We'll see exactly how that works out. You mentioned a term that I want you to explain for us, this term furlough, because this term has come up an awful lot in discussions like this in this past week. First of all, what's a furlough? And then, Jonathan, how does that actually differ from when somebody is actually terminated from a job?
Okay. So that's the advice I've been trying to give most of the employer clients I have for the last week. And now it's becoming more and more of a popular phrase, which I'm happy to hear. So a furlough does not destroy the employer-employee relationship. Okay, so basically, if I'm going to furlough one of my employees, I'm saying, listen, you are on an indefinite suspended leave without pay status. So you're not going to get paid, but it's a promise to the employee that when things pick up and that job is available again, that we're going to have you come in into that job. So the benefit, there's a couple benefits to the employee. Number one, the employee knows that there's a promise there that he or she still has the job. Number two, health insurance, if the employee had health insurance, still continues during that time. If there's a company life insurance, that still continues during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, the employee can still, like if they were unemployed, file an unemployment claim during that time. So it's the best way to handle it. Now, this is important for employers to know, okay? It's good. It's saving you money while you don't have to work. You don't have to pay salaries. You train talent. You want to retain the talent when things pick up. There's always the threat that the employee can leave. They're allowed to leave during that period of time, that he gets some part-time work during that time. But the biggest mistake that employers make is they don't disconnect them from email or anything company-related, because if you furlough an employee and then that employee starts to do some work for you, like emails, phone calls, whatever it might be, anything where the employer gets any type of benefit from the employee's action, that employee needs to be paid for that time. And if you're an hourly worker, the employer has to pay for the number of hours worked. If it's a salaried employee, you have to pay for at least a day and potentially even the entire week. So that's the only caveat that employers have to be very, very careful on, because if they don't pay them, they could be subject to a wage and hour lawsuit, and nobody wants to get hit with a lawsuit in this day and age for not doing things properly.
Mm. And that's another question that naturally comes up, and you're an excellent person to turn to in this regard. What do you think is the perspective or possibility, probability even, of lawsuits against employers as a result of some of the complications surrounding COVID-19, especially as this grows from weeks into months?
I think it really depends. I think that, you know, if you're a small business and you're virtually going out of business and you make some mistakes, you know, a law firm is not going to go after you, because at the end there's not going to be a possibility of collection. I think that if you are a major company or even a middle-sized company, but you're profitable and, you know, you're making mistakes, you know, there's really no excuse right now to make mistakes. There's plenty of labor and employment attorneys around. You got to call somebody knowledgeable to make sure this doesn't happen. But to the extent that you do make mistakes, and employees are hurt due to your mistakes, and if you in any way benefit from your mistake, then chances are eventually, probably not right away, but eventually you'll be hit with a lawsuit. Some of these lawsuits have statute of limitations for 3 years. Some of them have statute of limitations for 6 years. So you got to be very careful, and you got to seek guidance. And that's really the key. I mean, that's the key to any business. You can't fly blindly during these times. There's always new laws coming out. You had at the beginning of the week, I guess I'm focusing more on New York, but federally, I mean, there are some states that people go to work. So at the beginning of the week in New York, at least, the idea was let's pass laws so people who feel sick could stay home and people who have the coronavirus could stay home, because the thinking was if you feel sick, don't come to work because then it's going to spread. Bob, we all know that you don't have to show symptoms to get sick. I don't know why they took this approach at the beginning, which is why, in my opinion, things have escalated so quickly. But putting that aside, they started a law in New York that if you have 100 or more employees, you have to pay 14 days of paid sick leave, guaranteed, and that's in addition to whatever other sick leave policy that you have. And if you have under 100 employees or 99 or less, you have to pay 5 days of sick leave unless you have 10 or less employees and net less than $1 million, then you don't have to pay any sick leave, but you do have to hold the job open. So the intention was during that period of time, let's give people this benefit to feel free to stay home. And it covered whether you're staying home because you have the coronavirus or whether you feel sick and you're going for some type of treatment to determine if you have the coronavirus. And it was a decent attempt, but the problem is that that's for employers who want to continue doing business, who could do business. But unfortunately, what happened is that doesn't cover anybody who was actually laid off or fired. And they would have to apply for unemployment. So that's essentially what's been happening at the beginning of the week. And now it's all of this. Once you close businesses, it's all about unemployment. So what I'm going to do, Bob, if it's okay with you, I want to give your listeners a telephone number to call for New York State unemployment, in case they don't know. You want to call 888-209-8124. If you want to calculate right now, again, everything's going to change, and the benefits are going to be expanded. But for right now, if you want to determine what your benefit would be, there's a great website, unemployment-benefits.org. Okay? And also very important information for your listeners, because the unemployment office has been flooded with calls. They had, on Thursday, they had 350,000 logins by noon, as opposed to the average of 10,000 a day. So they decided to kind of break it down because people can't get through right now. Mm-hmm. So if your last name starts with A to F, you could call on Monday. If your last name starts with G to N, Tuesday, and if your last name starts from O to Z, you call Wednesday, and Thursday and Friday are for those people who missed their designated day. So I'm just trying to get some really useful information out to your listeners, of course.
Mm-hmm. Would you just repeat the phone number?
Sure, it's 888-209-8124. You could also log in through the Department of Labor, State of New York website and file a claim through that.
And the website that you mentioned about checking on that pertains to New York State?
That pertains to New York State, correct. That has nothing to do with what we discussed early in the program, which we're, again, crossing our fingers and hoping that the federal unemployment will come through for your workers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. By the way, we're talking with Jonathan Bell. He's a labor and employment attorney, founder of Bell Law Group. Would you give the website for your firm, by the way?
Thank you. Yes, it's www.bellllg.com. And a great way for you to get knowledge on what's going on a day-to-day. I've been doing daily video blogs on my Facebook page, which is at Bell Law Group, and my LinkedIn page. I do updates every day. And now, Bob, believe it or not, before I start the video, I have to start with the date, because things have changed so quickly. Like, for example, Cuomo first put in place 50% of your staff has to work from home and only 50% could go. I put that video up. The next day it was 75%. I put that up. Within a half an hour it was up to 100%. So things are changing so quickly that I almost feel like I not only have to put the date, I have to put the time, because of how frequently we need change given this escalating situation. I mean, the only small silver lining, and tough to say there's a silver lining when people are dying and the economy's shutting down. But I do see that people are spending a lot of time with family. They're going for walks around the neighborhood where they can, obviously keeping their social distancing lines, but for neighbors, waving. I'm seeing some real concern, which is something that we saw after 9/11 and other tragic events. So it seems like, from what I'm seeing here in Long Island, at least, that people are starting to come together, asking how you're doing, what can we do, and that's certainly nice to see.
It's nice to see. It's a shame that it takes something like this to get us to that point, literally, though. But
sure.
I guess we should at least be glad that people are showing concern for one another.
Yes.
Now, I'm glad that you mentioned this whole idea about the percentage of non-essential workers, because this has gotten confusing at times, and then everything just went through the roof on Friday, especially in New York, because Governor Cuomo basically said that 100% of non-essential workers should stay home. The figures are, the dates of those announcements are different in Connecticut, in New Jersey. This gets into an interesting area here, because one of the debates that often comes up then is, well, wait a minute, am I an essential worker or not? How do I determine if I'm an essential worker?
So that's a good question. And I can tell you that most employers who want to continue working, who, I don't want to say that they don't realize the severity of what's going on, but I guess, you know, they feel that need that, you know, maybe financially they need to, and they want to get their staff working. I mean, they're you know, I'm fortunate that I'm an attorney where I set up my office for people to always work from home. So in my office, for example, I have one attorney who always works from home. I have other attorneys that they have alternating days. So I'm set up and feel very fortunate for that way. Other places like restaurants and bars where actually, you know, mechanics, it requires you to go to your job, they have it a lot more difficult and they're shutting down. So everybody wants it deemed essential. But obviously on the list are the anyone that has to deal with the medical field, right? They're deemed essential. Even for the animals, veterinaries are deemed essential. Anything relating to food, okay, so grocery stores, supermarkets, even local restaurants where you can't go in and be served because they're involved in curbside pickup. I also heard that construction workers are deemed essential. So I believe that. And maybe during one of the breaks, I could pull up the actual list that Cuomo put out. But there is a list that goes over every field that's deemed essential. But the fact of the matter is, and this is important for your listeners to know, if you're not on that list and you have an employer who's forcing you to come in and you refuse to come in, because there's a state mandate, you cannot legally, and I use that word legally because anybody could be fired, but you cannot legally be fired. So if you get fired because you don't come in when there's a state mandate to stay home, you can eventually bring a claim. And that would be a perfect example as to why somebody would bring a claim, because you were really wrongfully terminated. So OSHA covers the fact that you could say no to doing something that your employer asks when you feel like your life is put into any type of danger or imminent danger. I believe now, this is the calls that I used to get before the mandate. Before the mandate, I was giving the opposite advice. I was saying, listen, if your employer wants you to come in and you're not sick and you're able to come in, but you just don't want to come in because you're afraid, technically you could be fired. And it doesn't seem like they could do anything because there is no mandate. There's no requirement to stay home. But in this situation, an employer cannot ask you to violate the law. So now that the mandate is up to 100%, you absolutely have the right to stay home as long as your company or business is deemed non-essential. For essential workers, it's the opposite. You have to come into work. You can't stay home just because you're fearful of getting the virus. If we had all the doctors do that, there'd be a lot more deaths. So the essential workers must go to work and they can be terminated. Again, if they've been diagnosed with the coronavirus or if they feel like they have the symptoms of the coronavirus and they're going out and getting checked then they could stay home. So that's really where the law is now.
And can an employer basically ask somebody to stay home or to leave work if they exhibit symptoms of COVID-19 or even of the flu?
I'm sorry, Bob. That question got lost at me. What was the question again?
Okay. Can an employer ask an employee to stay home or to leave work if they are exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19 or symptoms of the flu?
Yes. An employer can. Once this lift is up and we're able to go to work, I mean, these are the questions I've been dealing with. So, yes, if an employee shows up to work and they're showing some symptoms of COVID-19 or any type of illness, the employer could ask them to leave and show proof that they got a test before they're able to come back. And if it's negative, then they have to allow them back. However, an employer can't take out a thermometer and put it in the employee's mouth or do any other testing, because that violates both the ADA and HIPAA, okay? Also, if let's go to an important, again, this is now goes back to once we're back in the workplace, or even essential workers who have to work, okay? If an employee gets diagnosed with COVID-19, there's no duty for them to tell their employer, okay? There's no law that requires it because of HIPAA and ADA. However, there is a moral obligation. The employee really should tell the employer. Once the employee tells the employer that, the employer needs to ask, or really should ask the employee, who have you come into contact with here? Give me the names of those individuals. You should approach those individuals then and send them home for 14 days. But it's very important. You can't disclose the name of the person who told you that they tested positive for COVID-19. That's another violation, okay? So you got to tell the employee, by the way, another employee called, said they came into contact with you, was diagnosed with COVID-19. I'm allowing you now to stay home for 14 days to ensure that you don't have the symptoms of the virus. So that's really the correct way to handle a situation where you have an employee who advises the employer that they've been diagnosed with COVID-19.
And is that protection in there in terms of the anonymity of the person who says that they've been diagnosed with COVID-19? Is that anonymity in there to protect their identity from the standpoint of reprisals or things like that, or just what?
Yeah, it's... It wasn't anything new or specific that changed relating to COVID-19. If I'm an employee and I'm ill and I'm home and I tell my employer, hey, I have whatever it might be, whatever illness you have, they can't, due to HIPAA violations, go and disclose it to other people, in the Americans with Disability Act. It's just not permitted under the law that I could tell one employee what another employee's diagnosis is, if they share with me in confidence. And but realistically, to your point, though, that's also a good reason because, you know, people are really afraid of giving COVID-19. And so there's going to be some type of stigma or potentially retaliation over that person or employee who discloses the fact that he or she's been diagnosed. And also, if someone doesn't know that they have it, they come to work and they infect other people, then those people might be really angry at that employee, even though the employee really did nothing wrong. Which is why, fortunately, and again, it just took them longer than it should have, why it took them too long to close schools. You know, the whole theory behind it was just totally wrong. We understand that, you know, young children really don't get affected, don't have the symptoms of it. But everybody knows that they could be carriers. And then when you have all these kids in a school, you know, hanging out and touching and playing and grabbing the same things, and then they go home and they're infecting the parents and the grandparents, it just was such a obvious way for the escalation of this virus to, you know, be transferred upon one another. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to say too little too late, but it was a good idea to eventually close the schools. And, you know, this is the most severe quarantine I've ever seen in my life, and I'm 46 years old, and hopefully it'll be the last time because, you know, as you know, the economy was doing terrific before this happened, and I think it's going to take many, many years to dig out of this hole. But, you know, we've been through all this together, and we always seem to get through it.
The voice of Jonathan Bell. He's an attorney, labor and employment attorney, founder of Bell Law Group. He has joined us in this first hour of our program. We're going to take a pause in our discussion, come back, talk more with you, Jonathan, on our program here on The Fan.
Bob Salter, Sports Radio 101.9 FM,
The Fan,
and Sports Radio 66, WFAN.
Oh, we always love it when those jingle singers stop by on Sunday mornings. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We're in discussion with Jonathan Bell on our program. He's a labor and employment attorney, the founder of Bell Law Group, on the web at belllg.com, the website. And he's joined us to talk with us about a number of issues and concerns surrounding the COVID-19 coronavirus situation. One of the things I wanted to follow up on was talking about this whole idea of if somebody is a leave-eligible employee and they use their sick leave for this period of time that we've come to be here referred to as a self-quarantine period, but they use that time even if they don't develop symptoms. Is that permissible for them to do that?
If they don't develop symptoms, it is permissible to the extent that they are waiting for a doctor's appointment to be formally diagnosed. And if diagnosed, they're going to be either quarantined or non-quarantined, depending upon the outcome of the test. So, if you don't have any symptoms, you still might fall under the law guaranteeing you 14 or 5 days of paid sick leave, but it has to be caring for somebody who's been diagnosed during that time. Now, federal law has also changed, and they're coming out with, again, this is specifically related to the coronavirus, so there's an expiration date on it. The federal law starts April 5th and ends as an end date of December 31st, 2020. And that gives you 80 hours of paid sick leave. Everyone's guaranteed 80 hours of paid sick leave for the same reasons, and including if the school is closed and so for childcare purposes. Now, this is the difference. If you have the coronavirus and you're staying home for yourself, you are entitled to these 80 hours paid full pay, if you're watching over somebody who's been diagnosed or your child is home from school, it's not full pay. And it's limited to a maximum of $200 a day. So there is some variation depending upon the reason why you're home, and it's not in effect yet. It's supposed to take effect, like I said, early April. So they are trying to do their part. There's also something called, this is also important for your listeners to know, same starting date. Federal law has now passed extended FMLA. Extended FMLA is strictly to take care of your child who's home because of the school's closed, the nursery's closed, whatever it might be. That's 10 weeks. The first 10 days, if you invoke this, the first 10 days are unpaid, but the remainder of the 10 weeks are paid, your salary, two-thirds of your salary, again, up to $200 a day. But that's full 10-week time, and that's if you really can't work from home. So there are some good benefits coming out of this. Again, this was passed before at least the New York quarantine. I call it a quarantine, which is basically what it is. They want you to stay at home or just locally. But there are other states, I'm sure they're listening to your program. It's good for them to know because they're still required to go to work.
Well, this whole idea of if an employee is sick, the person's already exhausted their incidental sick time, any other form of paid time off. What then happens with that person?
So the beauty of the new New York State law and the federal law is it doesn't matter if you've exhausted your other leave. Your other leave is totally separate. They don't see the issue when this stuff was passing, Bob, was the fact that they wanted to give you additional leave. They don't want people to make a decision of, okay, I feel sick, but I have a vacation coming up in 3 months from now. Where do I use my leave? Maybe I should just go into work and infect other people and deal with it so I go on vacation. So what this law says, both federal and state, says, I don't care what leave the person has. You leave that alone. Leave that in their leave bank. This is, even if they use their previous leave for a flu or cold or a vacation, whatever it might be, this has to be in addition to the previous leave that you gave them. Now now the employer is like, wait a minute, this is some burden. I mean, not only am I expected to make profits in this economy and pay all my employees, but now you're giving me an extra burden of all this paid sick leave. The federal and state governments are giving tax credit, sometimes 100% tax credits for this additional pay. And those also exceptions, like, for example, the federal government laws that I described, it only applies to employers who have less than 500 employees. I'm not sure why they did that, but less than 500 employees are exempt from this law. If you have 50 or less employees, you could file for a hardship exemption. So it really leaves a lot of Americans not covered under this new law, which is not right. But for some reason, you know, I understand the 50 or less, because a lot of times you could argue that they might not be as profitable and they can't afford it, and this would destroy the viability of their business. But I'm not sure what the exemption is for the 500 or plus employees.
It's got to be extremely confusing trying to keep up with all these different changes and the like, because this is such a fluid situation.
That's why this is encompassing a lot of my time. Not only do I have to follow the changes, but then we have to then sit back, tell the clients I already have, plus new people who are calling me. And some of the laws are a little bit contradictory. Like New York State says 100 or more employees, the employer has to do this. But federal says 500 or less. So you got to figure out which one applies and what the obligations are. Because there's New York State, there's federal, sometimes there's New York City. Like New York City, I'm sure you know, because you're in New York City, has paid family leave. That has paid family leave and sick leave. Sick leave is is 5 days guaranteed, and Westchester adopted that. So it gets a little confusing for the average person, the average business owner who's trying to run their business and not deal with this, but that's why there's experts and people who do this for a living. The problem is that businesses sometimes, for a much smaller fee, they don't engage the people who do this for a living, and then they end up paying a lot more because they mess it up, and now they're subject to a lawsuit.
In the long run, what are some of the ways that you see the coronavirus really creating lasting change in the workplace as we know it?
Well, I'm going to speak for New York because this is where we are right now. But in New York, this is going to, they're predicting 20% unemployment rate. I think it's going to be a lot higher. I think we're going to be at 30 to 40% unemployment rate. It's very, listen, I understand you have to do it for health. It's people's lives are in jeopardy. We got to stay at home. But at the same time, it's virtually impossible for a lot of businesses to function. And even my business that could function, you just don't expect it to be as profitable as it otherwise would be. So there's going to be throughout the state, and the states especially that are mandated to stay at home, which other states might get to that level. And overall, I foresee a huge unemployment rate. I feel like people are going to be unemployed for a long period of time because the new jobs are going to be relatively scarce. They're going to have a lot of applicants competing for the same job. And listen, at the end, are we going to get through this? Of course we're going to get through this. It's just not going to be as comfortable for us as it's been for the last 10 plus years at this point in time.
And then the other issue that comes up is this whole issue of teleworking. Because for many people, this has been an option. Now, I think this is viewed in a completely different fashion in the workplace. Would you agree with that?
I would. I mean, and that's a great point, Bob. Realistically, like I said, in my office too, we've been teleworking or having the ability to telework for quite some time. I think that if we look at one positive thing that might come of this, is employers are going to recognize the value of telework. They're going to realize, hey, you know what? It's not that complicated given technology, whether it be, for example, Dropbox instead of a server in your office. Or, you know, filing a cloud-based Zoom for meetings. And employers are going to realize, you know what, when the economy gets better, this could actually save us an expense of renting an office. We just don't need it. So I think that this is going to make some businesses who really can get some value out of telework, who would have never realized it, now realizes that this might be a good option for them in the future.
But can that also create more areas that are kind of gray areas when you're talking about the rights of those who are employees?
100%. And it really is salary versus hourly. If you are appropriately, and I say that, you know, that's a very important word, appropriately a salaried employee making over the threshold of the FLSA, both New York State and federally, then technically your hours don't really have to be logged because you're not hourly. You get paid an agreed amount a year or week to week or biweekly, and you can literally work at any time and you're not guaranteed any more money. You work Saturday, Sunday. Your salary is what your salary is. For hourly employees, it's the opposite. If you have an hourly employee working from home, you have to be very, very strict with them with respect to the hours worked. You got to make sure that you have a reliable way to log in those hours. You have to have written policies in your handbook that they sign that basically states that outside your working hours, you're not to do any work, check your emails, take phone calls, anything that the employer benefits from. And if you do, you'll let me know. And if the company doesn't want to authorize it, they say, listen, we're not going to authorize you to do it. But if you do it, we're going to pay you for it because you did it, but we do reserve the right to discipline you as a result. So if an employee tells an employer, listen, I worked, 5 hours outside my shift, I know I didn't have the authority, the employer can't turn around and say, listen, you signed this document saying that you wouldn't do that, so now I'm not going to pay you. You're still opening yourself up to liability. You still have to pay them, although you could admonish them in writing, or shouldn't be verbal. It should be in writing. You could suspend them. You could even fire them, but you have to pay them for the work that they did.
Jonathan Bell on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning's first hour. Jonathan's labor and employment attorney, founder of Bell Law Group, BellLG.com, the website for his firm. Earlier in our discussion, you mentioned a website that is very important in New York State for people who are interested in finding out about unemployment benefits. Would you please repeat that?
Yeah, let's see, where do I have that written down for your listeners? Okay, so I have a telephone number, 888-209-8124, 888-209-8124, or you could just Google Department of Labor, New York State Unemployment, it'll come up. I am going to have that on one of my video logs today on my Facebook page. And also, Bob, what I did do is I went and I pulled up all the essential businesses, and there's so many of them, it's going to take a long time for me to read that list. So I am going to ask anyone who's interested in knowing which are the essential businesses to, again, go to my Facebook or LinkedIn page at Bell Law Group, and within the next couple hours, I'm going to put up a vlog of all those listed as essential businesses. Also, what I found during the break was that there's an exemption. If you work alone, regardless of what you do, non-essential, you could go into work and continue to work alone. So I thought that was an interesting exemption.
That is interesting. Jonathan, as always, thank you very much for joining us. Wonderful discussion. Provide some very good information. Stay well. Be healthy.
You too. Stay well, and thank you for having me.
Well, we're heading to 7 o'clock on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. Hour two of our program on Sunday morning. This is Bob Soldier. Yes, very good. Do a nice calming deep breath. Inhale. Exhale. One more time. Everybody, inhale. Slowly exhale. Now, don't you feel a little bit better? Calm down. Relax. Right? I know a lot of people are on edge. And that's something we're going to talk about in this hour of our program, is this whole issue of trying to keep one's sanity with the coronavirus. I think it's an important area of discussion. We just mentioned, too, that after our 8 o'clock update, it's the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf here on The Fan. And Ed Randall will be by talking baseball after our 9 o'clock update this Sunday morning. We move into a discussion in hour two of our program with a guest who is board certified as a psychiatrist. She's an award-winning and best-selling author. In her background, she was actually trained at NYU Bellevue and Anna Freud's London Clinic. She has served on the clinical faculty of UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute for years. She's known as Dr. Carol. Dr. Carol Lieberman is joining us on our program at this point. She is quite busy. in terms of things she's involved in. She hosts a couple of radio shows, podcasts, travels the world speaking about a variety of different topics. She has some books to her credit, her latest book for children, entitled Lions and Tigers and Terrorists. Oh My, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror. It comes from Troika Publishing. And she is kind enough to join us by phone from the state of California early on a Sunday morning for her. First of all, Dr. Carroll, good morning. Welcome to our program here on The Fan.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, you sound wide awake. All right. Good. All right. Many different things that I want to get into in our discussion with you, but I mentioned in starting this hour of our program this need for a perspective of sanity when it comes to talking about coronavirus. Would you agree with me that sanity is something that we need to sort of take a pause with?
Absolutely. This is the thing that has been really overlooked to such a large extent. I think we are scaring ourselves to death. People are not realizing, you know, there are all of these sensational headlines in the media and, of course, on emails, people trying to sell you things. You know, there was one email, coronavirus, the sneeze of death. That was supposed to then sell you something. So with all of these, you know, and even calling it the coronavirus crisis in the media instead of, I don't know, the coronavirus challenge or something, there isn't this effort to realize how significant it is that if you scare people, what happens is, you know, the more people are stressed or scared, the more it weakens their immune system, and then that makes it them more vulnerable, actually, to the coronavirus. So, you know, all of these rules and I don't know whether to call them laws necessarily, but the lockdowns or the stay-at-home guidelines, I understand about the value in terms of flattening the curve and all that, but there isn't anything being said or taken into consideration, really, about the impact of isolation, psychological and physical impact of isolation on people, which has, amongst other things, the impact of lowering their immune system and causing all kinds of problems.
And when you stop and think about it, you know, one of the things I had thought about in preparation for our discussion today was this whole idea of how can people who are listening to our talk really find ways to cope with this idea of being quarantined, which really is isolation when you get right down to it. And I mean, one of the things that in some states people have been encouraged to do, and a lot of people seem to be doing, is in some cases just where you can get out, take a walk a little bit. And a lot of people seem to do that. But at the same time, in other areas, we're hearing messages where people are being told, literally, don't leave your home, except in a very emergent situation.
Mentally, yes, it's all rather confused.
It's a lot to deal with that, yes, because you're hearing conflicting messages, too.
Right. Well,
so how does somebody cope with that, Dr. Carroll?
Well, I have various suggestions for that. I can start with that. I mean, the things that people, here's the thing, you know, we are hearing talk about conflicting views or instructions and so on. We are hearing, even just in regard to the coronavirus, we are hearing so many different accounts by scientists or doctors or people, you know, giving us information about this in terms of how many feet we should stay away. I mean, some people, of course, mostly say 6 feet, then 5 feet, or then 3 feet when it doesn't suit you to do 6 feet, right? Or 15 feet. And the same thing with how long the coronavirus lives outside of a person, you know, and depending upon the surface and so on. So there's all this conflicting information. And bottom line, you can't outsmart or outwit the virus. So what you have to concentrate on, instead of all of these panicky headlines and so on, what you have to concentrate on is what you can control. And what you can control is what you do for yourself. And that is how healthy you can make yourself psychologically and physically. So psychologically, the most important thing would be to do all every day to be doing things that decrease your stress, from meditation to listening to calming music to taking a walk. You know, certainly everybody can, or most people can, at least in New York. I know I'm a New Yorker born and bred. So, you know, you can at least stick your head out the window if you don't have a terrace, or you could walk around the block and try to stay away from people. So, and also I'm recommending that people, this is a great time for families to adopt a pet, because pets are very comforting. Then also, of course, the things that your mother told you or should have told you when you were a kid, the basics, you know, we all hear, wash your hands. But in addition to that, eat nutritious food, take vitamins, get enough sleep, get enough exercise. I mean, so many people are up in the middle of the night listening to the radio or watching the television or going on the internet, you know, trying to read more about coronavirus. And that, of course, is really not helping their health. And then, so that's one of my next recommendations, to avoid fear-mongering news stories or associating with fear-mongering people. And then it's important, even if you're in isolation or quarantine, to keep in touch with people. You should make a list of all the people who you want to be in contact with, or who you're concerned about, want to reach out to, who, you know, maybe might need to hear your voice. And then just every day call at least three of them, at least. Then one thing that people aren't doing is to visit their doctor, not necessarily if they are feeling coronavirus symptoms. I mean, of course, then you do that. But even if you're not necessarily feeling anything, that you're not feeling sick at the moment, but you want to check that you don't have any underlying condition, because that will make you have a more serious coronavirus illness if you do indeed get it. But even if you do have, especially if you do have underlying illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, and so on, you should go and make sure that this condition is really at its optimal state. You're taking the right medicines, you're doing all the right things for it. And then if you're what I call coronavirus stress syndrome, if it's really out of control, then you can get psychotherapy even from your home. And then, of course, a plan. You know, as your last guest was saying, things are changing like even every hour. So you kind of have to keep revising your plans, but you should have a plan. Like, what if this lasts 2 weeks? What if this lasts 2 months? And if you at least have a plan B and C and D, then that can be calming as well.
Let's go back to the very beginning of that answer, and I appreciate what you just shared with us. This connection and this need to, many people have to constantly be connected, looking for the latest update. They have to have all this news. I mean, how potentially dangerous is this, the addiction that some people have developed to their devices?
Well, you mean particularly now, of course, in regard to coronavirus. Mm-hmm. It is very dangerous. You know, after 9/11, there were studies that showed that people who kept tuning into television, kept watching the Twin Towers fall, did develop a certain percentage of them, did develop PTSD, even if they were nowhere near the Twin Towers or any other place that was hit by 9/11. And I think that the same thing is happening here now that the more, because PTSD comes from being exposed to a life-threatening problem. And so, of course, just like, you know, terrorism, coronavirus is also potentially life-threatening. And so the more that you just keep watching this and keep, you know, hearing about the statistics and so on in a very alarming kind of way, which really, I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, not in a good way, but the way that statistics are being presented are also being sensationalized. I mean, the statistics, I'm just looking at on the internet, the number of cases that there are in the U.S. Is approximately 26,000-27,000. And not that that's anything to sneeze at, you should excuse the pun, but and the number of total deaths is 348. I mean, not that that is, any death is really sad, but you would, I bet you, if you went on the street and you asked someone this question, how many people do you think have died already in the U.S. from coronavirus? They would give you a number much higher than that.
Exactly.
And everything is being presented. And when you think about, you know, the actual flu, the regular old, common old flu, so far this year, in the flu season this year, 2019-2020, this flu season, there have been over 14,000 people who have died. 16,000. Over 16,000 so far who have died. So, I mean, you know, but these numbers aren't being put into context. And so, I mean, I don't. That's the part, I must say, this is the part that I struggle with every day. Why? You know, I mean, okay, the obvious answer to get ratings and so on. But besides that, it seems like there's more to it for why, what is behind us being scared to death, making us scared to death.
When we're talking about some of the restrictions, changes in the way in which people are living now, one of the things that probably has a big impact on a lot of folks is this whole idea of gyms being closed.
Uh-huh.
What's the psychological effect of not being able to exercise?
Yes, that has a very significant effect. I mean, exercise is a great stress reliever. And in addition to that, it makes us feel like we're doing something good for ourselves. So it makes us feel good about ourselves, makes us feel like productive and so on, which is why, I mean, I can see that's one of the few places that I could see why it's closed. Because, you know, people's bodily fluids and, I mean, there is more of a, that is more, and people definitely are very close together, like in classes and so on, and using the machines, touching the same machines. You know, I could see that. But that isn't an excuse for people not to exercise. As I was saying before, taking a walk, even just simply taking a walk, you know, or some people have things in their home where you can make things. You can, you know, you can pick up two cans of soup, raise it over your head. You can be resourceful and think of things to do in your own home that's exercise.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We're going to take a pause in our discussion with you and come back, talk more with Dr. Carol Lieberman. Dr. Lieberman is a board-certified psychiatrist in Beverly Hills, California. She is an award-winning and best-selling author. We've got a lot more to talk with her about on our program On the Fan this Sunday morning.
Bob Salter, Sports Radio 101.9 FM, The Fan, and Sports Radio 66, WFAN.
It's Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. Long after our 8 o'clock update is Rick Wolf with the Sports Edge program. We're in a discussion with Dr. Carol Lieberman. Dr. Lieberman's board-certified psychiatrist in Beverly Hills, California. She's joining us early on a Sunday morning. She's originally from New York, and she's got a lot to share with us in our discussion. We're talking about some of the effects of the coronavirus and the way in which we live, some of the heightened sense of awareness slash hysteria that there is associated with this. And we'll also get into talking about how it is that she recommends that parents talk with their kids about this. But I wanted to ask you a couple of questions just as a follow-up to something that, in a way, we were talking about in the first hour of our program this morning. And that is, a lot of people are out of the traditional workplace as a result of concerns about the coronavirus. Is it possible, do you think, for some people to simply lose their motivation to ever return to the workplace?
Hmm. That's a good question. I mean, in addition to the fact that there are going to be so many businesses that go out of business.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes, I think that that is definitely possible, especially, you know, if, I mean, you know, I was starting to say isolation itself can have such an impact. For example, it affects the cardiovascular system. It causes, can cause heart attacks and strokes. And, of course, psychologically, it can cause anxiety and depression and even some suicidal ideation. And there's the mortality from these kinds of illnesses. Basically, it's like stress. It's like stress in general. It's a kind of stress. And stress, you know, causes everything from headaches to high blood pressure. And as I was saying, especially it decreases the immune system. That's especially important today, you know, with coronavirus, and makes us more susceptible to everything from colds to coronavirus to cancer. And so all of these things by isolate, and just doesn't seem like the people who are making these decisions that we should quarantine or isolate or lock down, whatever you want to call it, don't seem to be aware or are taking enough those kinds of things into consideration, because the death rate from these kinds of problems from the isolation is probably more than the death rate from coronavirus, which is still really low. That's another thing. I was talking about how figures or statistics are presented. You know, the death rate really in our country is really still around 1%. The reason why there's often a higher figure given is because it's looking at the whole world. So when you start, of course, with China and then add Italy, and those death rates have been much higher, then that brings the total death rate up, you know, if you're looking at the whole world. But for the U.S., it really is not that high. And then you have to take into consideration all these other things that are going to be consequences. And just like 9/11, we have seen, and I have been studying this because when 9/11 happened, that changed my life, even though I wasn't at that time in New York. My daughter was going to college there. But I decided after 9/11 that I was going to devote the rest of my life to helping people cope with the ongoing threat of terrorism, which people seem to be forgetting in this epic of coronavirus right now. But anyhow, that's a whole other interview. But we can learn from some of the things that happened in the long run after 9/11. And it's going to be worse in a way, depending on how long the coronavirus issue lasts and how long we're isolated and what the economic effects and so on. But things like after 9/11, there has been an increase in obesity because people began then and are continuing to stuff themselves with comfort food. Well, what do you think people are going to be doing now when they're isolated? I mean, granted, in some places, sometimes food is not that easy to get, but it's getting more prevalent, more available. We could expect more obesity. We can also expect people to be engaging in alcohol and drugs more during this period of isolation. And of course, as I was saying before, anxiety and depression and so other psychiatric problems. So those are the things that have to be weighed against what we're doing right now.
What about the potential for an increase in divorce because of the quarantines?
Yes, that is a whole, there is definitely going to be an increase in divorce and an increase in babies, and which is going to be a bad combination. There's going to be, couples are either going to get closer together if they can find creative ways to try to relate to each other, discover new things about each other, be united together against the common enemy of coronavirus, that kind of thing. But I think for a lot of couples, it's going to be the opposite way. You know, things that bothered you about your significant other before, but when you were separated, you each were going to work, or one of you was going to work, so they weren't together 24/7. Now all these little things that bothered you about them are going to be heightened, you know, because you're going to be exposed to them for many more hours a day. So, and plus all the fear, that can either have the extreme effect of bringing a couple together or making them go farther apart, getting angry, which is another thing. Domestic violence, unfortunately, is going to increase the cases of that. And then what? You know, if couples feel like they can't leave, I mean, you know, obviously, if you're getting angry at your significant other and you feel like you're going to explode, you should go out and take a walk, regardless of whether you're on isolation, quarantine, or whatever you want to call it.
This whole idea of collective fear with coronavirus, a natural question heading into a discussion like the one we're having today is to ask you, is this something that's legitimate or is it overblown?
The fear?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, it is definitely overblown. I mean, I don't mean, you know, I always hesitate when I mean, when this first started, I created what I called the coronavirus stress syndrome with 10 symptoms, and if you have at least 3, then you have it. And some of the things that were on that list is basically an overreaction to coronavirus. And some of the things that are on the list are now things that we are being told to do. Like, for example, my most extreme was staying at home until the pandemic passes. And so, you know, now in some places, that's what you're being told to do. So, but I think everyone is overreacting to it. Again, some people can't die from it. There are going to be deaths, but as I was saying before, the flu still has a higher death rate, and as does isolation, we're going to see. And it isn't doing us any good. You know, it's like what FDR said in 1933, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Hmm. How can someone who's listening to our discussion today deal with a person or people who just seem to be in a perpetual state of panic over the virus?
Yes, it's so interesting. The more people I talk with, the more I hear about either they or people they know are freaking out, is how they describe it. And a lot of these people are very intelligent people who, and otherwise relatively calm, who you just would not expect to be freaking out over this. But it is the hype. It is the hype. The headlines, floods of patients, preparing for floods of patients. What else? I'm looking at, there have been so many interesting, you know, this whole thing, of course, about panic buying for toilet paper. Is crazy. I mean, that's an example of mass hysteria and not just coronavirus stress, but coronavirus psychosis, you know? I mean, yes, we all need toilet paper. Oh, and then this is such a good example. We all need toilet paper, of course. But, like, you knew that when there was this shortage of toilet paper, that people were going to be using other things, and they were going to be flushing them down the toilet. And sure enough, mm-hmm. I don't know whether this is a problem in New York. I imagine it is. But sure enough, in California, there have been headlines about how the sewers are getting stopped up because of all the things that people are flushing down the toilet. When you're mm-hmm. stressed out or terrified, you don't think in a common sense kind of way. And this is an example of what happens.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that because it simply was incredible the level of panic that people got into over this inability to have toilet paper. And then the other aspect of this is this whole idea of hoarding.
Yes.
Where people, you know, I've been in, unfortunately, and I do say this unfortunately, I've been in a number of stores over the past week, including yesterday. And not that long after our program today, I'll be in another one. Okay. But I don't go into the store with the mindset I'm there to buy everything possible, that the end of days is at hand, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that so many people are just, I watch people pushing carts that they can barely move because they're so loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what on earth is going on? You know, have people just lost their minds?
Yes, people really are literally losing their minds. You know, it's like what, squirrels hoarding nuts for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's sort of a delusion that if you have enough toilet paper or you have enough whatever, you know, you grab and to hoard, that somehow that will protect you from dying or from the end of days. That objects, and of course food, you know, is especially symbolic because it's the nurturance, you know, it goes back to, we're regressing is what's happening. I mean, that's like what I was talking about before, people eating comfort food, but we're regressing to the stage of being a baby and getting satisfaction or getting fulfillment from being fed, either, you know, at a bottle or a breast, and wanting that feeling of nurturance and of comfort. And also comfort food, by the way, comes from, like, the things that people pick for comfort food have to do with what they received from their parents when they were growing up. If they, if something bad happened and their parents wanted to, you know, cheer them up and gave them ice cream or cookies or pasta or whatever it was, that's what they tend to go to in times like this, because really what they're looking for is that feeling of comfort, like everything's going to be okay.
Mm. And that there's a need for them to feel that. There's a need for them to feel reinforced by having that present. Is that what it is?
Well, just comforted. The same, it's the memories. Whether it's the memories of being a baby and being comforted and held while you're being fed, or the memories of being comforted by some special treat food by your parents for either for having, you know, maybe for failing a test and wanting to make you feel better, or not getting picked for the school play, or on the other side, some celebration of something that you did well. So it's the good memories that you're trying to recreate with a particular kind of food or food in general.
Mm. We're talking with Dr. Carol. Dr. Carol Lieberman is talking with us this hour of our program on FAN. And one of the things I want to get into when we return, we're going to take a pause for a few messages here. I want to pose a question to you that I'd like you to explore when we come back, is the ways in which you think this country is going to be forever transformed after the virus passes, which hopefully will be sooner rather than later. Dr. Lieberman, take a pause in our discussion, come back with you, and talk more on our program On the Fan this Sunday morning.
Bob Salter, Sports Radio 101.9 FM,
The Fan,
and Sports Radio 66, WFAN.
It's the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf, long after our 8 o'clock update. Ed Randall's talking baseballs long after our 9 o'clock update this Sunday morning. And we are in a discussion with Dr. Carol Lieberman on our program. Dr. Lieberman has joined us by phone. She's a board-certified psychiatrist. She's joining us from her home in California. A couple of different things I want to touch upon in the home stretch of our program this morning, and one of them I posed to you as a question before our messages there. In what ways do you think this country is going to be transformed once this virus does pass?
Well, I would like to say, and it certainly is possible, that necessity could be the mother of invention, and we could, you know, dig down into our resourcefulness and come up with all kinds of exciting new ways to improve lives. I am, however, very concerned about a number of things that would not be so good for our country. Again, depending upon how long this lasts and depending upon what kinds of guidelines we're being given. For example, you know, obviously with the stock market being on a roller coaster and the mass layoffs from failing businesses, you know, it's hard to even, I think people, it's scary to even think about just how, what kind of an economic turmoil we could be thrown into. And, you know, this whole idea of how much more money we are needing, giving people money, and I mean, not that there's much of a choice, but all of the bailouts or the things that we're spending money on, in addition to the fact that we're not producing money, you know, doing things to make money. So it's too horrible to even contemplate all the way down that road. And as you were saying about, could people lose ambition because of being laid off and so on, which I think is a good point. Also, I love the way the New York governor has talked about non-essential workers. When I heard that, I was thinking to myself, I mean, you know, I get what he means, but if you happen to be in a job that is considered non-essential, psychologically, that certainly there could have been a better way of putting that than making all these people feel as though they don't count. They're not important. They can just go away and nobody's going to miss them. I mean, these are the kinds of things that I mean, that there isn't being enough thought, isn't psychological thought, isn't being put into some of the rules that are being given down. Then closing schools, of course, you know, that in itself is having a huge negative impact. First of all, just education-wise, I mean, that's the primary thing. Yes, some schools are having online teaching, but not all schools can do that. And not all students are really going to be, you know, going online or able to go online and continue studying. It also makes a problem for parents, because what if two parents work, or if it's a one-parent family, you know, and what do you do with your children? And there's all these different rules about whether they can be daycares that are open and so on. Another thing that could be done so much better and is not being done. I mean, there's so much really that could be done that to help us in this situation that isn't being done. For example, instead of all this scary, negative, sensationalized news, there should be more news about positive things that are happening, like how about more interviews of people who have recovered from the coronavirus? You know, for example, because there's more testing going on, of course it's going to turn out that we now know that more people are positive because there are people who aren't having any symptoms. And if they get a test and turns out positive, so their number goes up in the statistics. But you know, they aren't really having, it doesn't mean that the virus is worse. In fact, it means that because it means that there are more people who are better or who aren't symptomatic and who are positive. And yet that kind of news doesn't really make it, at least not very much or not very big. The other thing is that when you're giving bad news about something health-related, you're always supposed to, and I learned this when I was, getting my master's in public health after my MD, about how to use the media to improve, prevent illness and to treat it. You always are supposed to provide, if there's anything scary that you report or anything negative, you're always supposed to provide positive kinds of things after the negative. And so far, I mean, really, for the most part, the positive things have just been wash your hands, you know, or sneeze into your elbow. Actually, there isn't much press given to the Wuhan shake. Do you know what the Wuhan shake is?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a fun thing for people to do, and that I haven't heard that being talked about, to shake each other's legs one at a time, obviously, mm-hmm. instead of shaking hands. And then, of course, another thing, you know, the jails and prisons are being at least, I think all over the U.S., or at least in some places all over the U.S., the jails and prisons people are being let out. So here we have, I mean, just think of this. Here we have the good people being isolating or quarantining, right? And we have all the prisoners being let out into the streets. I mean, again, this is one of these things like, aren't you thinking about the consequences? And then panic buying. We talked about toilet paper, but I'm sure you know that there's also been panic buying of guns. So right. we're isolating, losing our humanity, and then more people are panic buying guns. Not that this isn't about, I'm not saying anything about, you know, against guns. I'm just saying that under these circumstances, you know, if everybody's holed up, and they have a gun, and they've lost their connection with other people, that's also a very scary scenario. So we have to get on top of these things. I mean, I feel bad to some degree, you know, talking about all these things, but I'm doing it so that people can kind of wake up and recognize that maybe we need to rethink some things, or certainly the really most important thing is something I said at the beginning, which is that we have, what we can control is our individual health, our psychological health and our physical health, by doing all the things that I talked about that I'm sure, you know, your listeners know also additional things related to that, to be resistant to, both to the effects of isolation and to the coronavirus.
You have some steps that you recommend in the area of promoting coronavirus sanity, for lack of a better term, for parents and children.
Yeah.
Can you share those with us?
Yes. Well, first of all, kids follow their parents' lead. So if parents tell their kids, you know, try to just push it under the rug, you know, don't worry, or there's nothing happening out there, and then the kids see their parents running down the aisles of grocery stores with masks and or gloves and trying to grab toilet paper or anything else that there is on the shelves, that is giving them the message that you are panicked. And so they're not just afraid of the coronavirus at that point, but they're afraid that their parent has gone off the deep end. So the first thing parents have to do is to not panic themselves. And then to find fun things that kids can do or that you can do with your kids to relieve stress, from coloring books to dancing, putting on music that they like and dancing in the living room. And I mentioned before getting a rescue pet. And then the easiest way to explain coronavirus to kids is to say that it's like the flu, like the cold, a cold or the flu. Sometimes it can get worse than that, but for the most part, it's like a cold or the regular flu. And then this is a great time, a great opportunity for parents to teach the kids the things that I was mentioning later before about that they need to learn and practice for their whole life, the eating nutritious food and taking vitamins and getting enough sleep and exercise. And then, of course, you know, see, this is kids that are home from school. What are they going to do? Most of them, they're going to be sitting in front of the television. What are they going to be watching? All kinds of news about how we're all going to die from coronavirus. So obviously, you need to limit that for your kids. Don't let them watch the news. And you know, you can certainly talk about, depending on how old they are, you can certainly talk to them about coronavirus in terms of the you know, like, what is a virus? And what is this virus like, and what do we know about it? That's okay, but not in a scary way. And then one of the big things is, you know, some of the kids have been, especially at the beginning of this, they were bullying Chinese kids, a lot of xenophobia. Even now, well, now a lot of the schools are closed, but blaming, they don't really understand, especially if they're really young, they don't really understand that these Chinese kids are not to blame. And so even not just China, but, you know, then Italy and Iran and all of that. So you have to teach them that it's not the fault of your playmates.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other areas that naturally comes up too, for parents with kids, how do you recommend they deal with situations where the child will say, talk about something very scary that they were told by a friend, by a classmate, etc.?
Yes, yes, that is a big problem, because kids want to show other kids that they know more, or yep, want to scare the other kids. Because then that makes them feel more powerful if they can scare somebody else, because they're really scared. That's why they're doing it. So you have to tell your kids to tell you anytime someone tells you something about this illness that that you're not sure about, or to tell you any, to talk to you about things that they're scared of or things that they heard that their friends said. To encourage communication. You know, a lot of the things that that I'm telling parents to do about coronavirus are similar to what I wrote about in my book about terrorism for kids. You know, how to notice whether your kids are feeling anxious, what to do about, how to notice whether they need professional help. But I think, you know, the problem is, one of the things ways that it's different from 9/11 is that in 9/11 we had one major thing that helped us get through it, is that we all had community support, social supports. We helped each other, and we still can do this even though we're isolated with the phone and the computer and all of that. There are ways, FaceTime and everything else. But we have to make a little more effort to make that happen. But that is so, so important. And again, not with people who are fear mongers, you know, try to calm their fears if you can, or tell them what to do to calm their fears. But we do need this social support.
And one of the key things to keep in mind, whether it's for your kids or for yourself, goes back to something I said at the very beginning of this hour. Calm down.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Whether it's for your kids or yourself, calm down. This whole idea of panic, it's just spirals completely out of control.
And paradoxically, it's making you more vulnerable to catching coronavirus. So, all the time that you have that you're not going to work or not going to the gym, all the things that you would be doing otherwise, take that time and spend it on doing things that are good for yourself, for you to calm yourself and to make yourself healthier.
Excellent point, and a great way to wrap up our discussion. Dr. Carol Lieberman, our guest on our program on The Fan this hour of it, thank you very much for joining us and sharing the insights that you have. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for our program this Sunday morning. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf is along with the Sports Edge program. And don't forget what I said at the very beginning of this show today. You want to keep calm. Part of that, go back to the exercise we started this hour with. Everybody, join with me. Inhale. Exhale. One more time. Inhale deeply. Hold it. Exhale slowly. There you go. It's that calming sense. Relax. We will get through this. I know it's tough. It's a bit scary. But we'll get through it. Now, stick around for the Sports Edge. And then, well, I've often said the fortunes of broadcasting change. You'll understand exactly what I mean by that if you're around after a 9 o'clock update. Mark Renee is going to bring us our top of the hour sports flash. We will see you next Sunday morning. Our thanks to a phenomenal job by Pete Hoffman. And have a great Sunday, everybody. This is Bob Salter.